There we go. All right, let's get started. I'm Alan White. I manage a consulting practice in Ohio called UpSearch. And here's the email address and Twitter handle where you can reach me if you choose to do so after the fact, if you have any questions later on. I hope if you have questions, feel free to ask them. Hopefully we're going to have some fun. Just a little bit information about me. I've been around IT for a very long time. I've done a whole lot of different things, development, operations, DBA work, etc. I've been working with SQL Server for over 20 years now. I've been a Microsoft MCT for 7 years, and the last 6 years I've been a Microsoft MVP. I'm waiting for word on Monday whether I've been renewed for another year, so I'm crossing my fingers for that. So it's a really great program. It's all based on contributions to the community. So again, another request for you to come up and present yourselves. Microsoft does recognize those of us that do offer our contribution to the community in the terms of the MVP program, and it's a marvelous program. All right, how many of you have never worked with PowerShell before? So in the United States, we raise our hands to, I know, I'm trying to make a joke. You've never worked with PowerShell before. A few of you. It's what was interesting when I presented this in New Orleans 3 weeks ago, about a third of the audience raised their hands. They'd never worked with PowerShell. So I want to make sure that I give at least a basis for PowerShell before we go on to the SQL Server related things. PowerShell is part of the Windows Management Framework, and Windows Management Framework 3.0 came out with Windows Server 2012. They are getting ready to release Windows Management Framework 4.0 coming up sometime soon. I'm not sure when. But it uses a protocol that's a SOAP-based protocol called WinRM to manage your computers. It's a much more lightweight and efficient protocol. It uses this BITS, this background file transfer service. So, and PowerShell, when PowerShell came out in 2006, it was declared to be part of the Microsoft Common Engineering Criteria. So all server products have to be cooperative at least with PowerShell. And that's the best I'm going to say for the SQL Server interface. It is cooperative with PowerShell. There are products like Exchange. Exchange 2007 was completely rewritten with PowerShell as the interface to Exchange. And then they wrote the GUI on top of PowerShell. Fast forward a few years to 2012. By this point, Jeffrey Snover leaves the PowerShell team as the lead architect for the Windows operating system. Windows Server 2012 comes out with 2,300 new commandlets for the Windows operating system. Windows is catching up to what the Exchange team did, and I'm hoping at some point the SQL Server team will head in that direction as well. But we can use PowerShell to access all of the system, not just SQL Server. And I'm used to working with a lot of the SQL Server MVPs who feel they can do everything through DMVs. And you can do most everything you need to do through DMVs, except you can't really get access to the operating system information that really comes in handy when you're trying to troubleshoot a problem. And so we're going to get into that today. Jeffrey Snover at an MVP summit in 2012 said in his keynote to the PowerShell MVPs, PowerShell is a core IT skill. Learn it or be left behind. So I'm glad you're here. Thank you. Command line is the environment I choose to work in PowerShell. I've been in IT for a very long time. I started out with punching cards, okay? The command line is a step up from that, and I'm not uncomfortable with it. There's a lot of help you get from the command line. You can start to type a command and hit the tab, and it will complete that command for you. You can use the get history commandlet to see a list of what you've already done. Or you can do like I do, is as you're working through some ideas and they start to make sense, I redirect get history into a text file, and that becomes the start of the script that I write, because I've already done those tasks and I know they work. Right? So you can use the up and down arrows to scroll through commands you've already done, so that will save you a lot of typing. PowerShell 1.0 just came with the command line. That came out in 2006. 2009 introduced PowerShell 2.0, and an integrated scripting environment came out with PowerShell. I personally didn't care for it. I felt it was too cut up and cumbersome to work with. Again, because I'm comfortable with the command line, I stayed with it. PowerShell 3.0 came out last year. It came out with a new integrated scripting environment that includes IntelliSense, so it helps you along the way and shows you syntax for the commandlets you're using. So I highly recommend, if you're starting out in PowerShell, that you start working with the ISE. I'm not going to be doing that today because I want to get right into the meat of the things that we're going to work with, but I strongly recommend you work with the integrated scripting environment. Scripts, of course, allow you to batch your commands together because this automates a series of processes that you're going to do on a regular basis. You know, if you do it once, the GUI is fine, but how many people do things just once? Just once. I don't know of anyone. I'm always going to be doing something a second time. If I'm doing it a second time, why not script it so every other time I need to do it, it's already written? One thing with PowerShell is you must include the full path of the script before you can execute it, right? Because that avoids something called hijacking in cmd.exe or DOS. I could put a batch file called dir.bat somewhere in a folder that's in the path in environment variable. I could put it in the some folder in the path ahead of the Windows command folder, and when I type in dir, it'd execute dir.bat. That's hijacking. PowerShell prevents that. It requires that you identify the location of the script. Now, if I'm in a directory, and you'll see me do this in the demos today, if I'm in a directory, I type in ./ and the name of the script, and it runs it because I'm saying run it from my current directory. By default, when you install PowerShell, you cannot run scripts. When you first install the Windows operating system and you've got PowerShell there, by default, it's the execution policy is set to restricted. The PowerShell MVP suggests best practices. You set it to remote signed, which allows you to run scripts you've created locally. If you download a script or copy a script from someplace else, and if you go into Windows Explorer, you right-click on it, you can see the property, and there's that unlock button. If you unlock that file, you can run that script when you're in remote signed mode. Other than that, the script must be digitally signed. And to find out more about that, get help on execution policy or on set execution policy, and it'll explain to you more and more details as you get into that. One important thing about the execution policy, though, is that if you're using SQL Server 2008 or 2008 R2, it installs SQLPS.exe. SQLPS.exe is PowerShell 1.0 with the SQL Server add-on extensions. Those add-on extensions are required for you to be able to use the PowerShell task type in SQL Server Agent. SQL Server Agent has added that PowerShell task type. When you run the PowerShell task in SQL 2008 R2, it will run your script using SQLPS.exe, not the PowerShell that came with Windows. So I recommend that you look and see if that's the case. If you want to use PowerShell 2 or 3 features from SQL 2008, use the Windows Command Exec task type and type in PowerShell and add the name of your script after that. Then it will use PowerShell 2.0 or 3.0, whatever is on your server. SQLPS.exe, the execution policy by default is set to remote signed because that allows you to run PowerShell scripts from SQL Agent. an important thing to remember, PowerShell is an object-based language. It is not an object-oriented language. So you'll use objects. Objects are simply memory space that have defined properties and methods. They're data types that have defined properties and methods, and we'll look at that in just a minute. Commandlets are the basic working building blocks of PowerShell. Commandlets are your utilities. They have a verb-noun naming convention. Get process tells you all your processes on your server. Stop service will stop a service. I have another presentation that I do on using PowerShell remoting to manage SQL Server. And when I'm done with my presentation, I use stop computer and the name of the computer through all of the servers that I'm working with, and it just shuts every one of them down right from my client. It's a very convenient tool to have, but it's also very powerful, obviously. The three most important things you want to remember: get help, because you can get help on any commandlet, any function that's in your system. Get help will give you Unix man type help on anything that's in your system. You can even get help on get help. And yes, there's an alias for it called man. There's also an alias for it called help, right? So just type in help, get help, and you can start with that. This explains to you the syntax. It gives you examples. It gives you details, as much detail as you want. The second one is get command. Get command is your discoverability. What can I do in PowerShell? Get command will tell you. It will give you a list of all of the commandlets. You can specify get command dash noun, and it'll give you all of the nouns that are available to you. Say get command on computer dash verb, say computer, and it'll give you all the commandlets that use the verb. I'm sorry, my brain went backwards. If I say get command dash noun computer, it'll bring me back all of the commandlets associated with computer. So get command will give you all of the commandlets you've got available to you. Lastly, get member. If you pipe a variable of any type, obviously it has to be some type, if you pipe a variable to the get member commandlet, it will tell you what variable type that is and show you all the properties and methods associated with that. You're going to be using variables. Variables start with a dollar sign and then any sequence of characters after that. The dollar sign is the indicator that this is the start of a variable. You want to assign values to that. The assignment operators are the equal sign. You can also use plus equal and minus equal. I use plus equal when I'm adding a member to a collection, for example. But the equal sign is always, always, always an assignment operator. The comparison operator is dash EQ. Don't mix those up. You'll hurt yourself. I have done it many times. I continue to do it. It's a common mistake. It's just natural to type the equal sign, but it will burn you if you don't test your script thoroughly. All right, so your comparison operators for conditional operations are listed there. Not equal, less than or equal to, greater than, equal to, etc. Okay? Again, all variables are .NET objects. PowerShell is built in cooperation with on top of .NET. All of the objects it works with are .NET, and all of the features that you have available in .NET are available to you in PowerShell. Again, use getMember to see those properties, methods, types, etc. Let's get into a demo. I told you, the command line. We could switch. Let me show you real quick. If I go into the PowerShell ISE, where am I? If we go into Accessories, Windows PowerShell, PowerShell ISE. Yes, that's Zion National Park in Utah. See, I just typed in get dash, and it showed me the different commandlets that are available. So get command, and it brings back all of the commandlets. It brings back aliases and functions as well in here. I won't belabor that, but I love the ability within the ISE for the IntelliSense. So I'm hovering over get process. It says get process, and then it's showing me the syntax. This is why I suggest that if you're just starting out in PowerShell, that you start out with the ISE, because it helps you along. There's also the ability, if you go into view, is this it? Yeah. So if I go into add computer, here are all the properties, and I can just simply fill in the properties that go along with my arguments, and it constructs that command and places it in my executable window. How cool is that? Right? So there's your discoverability, part of it. Let me jump back into my virtual machine. I showed you the syntax for get process, but here's get process. Here are the results. So this just shows me all the processes that are running on my system. But one of the really cool things about PowerShell is the pipeline. So I could say get process, pipe the results from get process. Because everything is objects, I don't have to do any sed, grep, awk type gymnastics with the output of get process. I just pipe that to the sort object, sort on the working set in descending order, pipe that to select object, and select just the first 10. There are the 10 most memory consuming processes on my server. How convenient is that when you're trying to troubleshoot a performance problem? To be able to know right off the top what my 10 most memory consuming processes are. Right? So these are the kinds of things that PowerShell brings to the table. Wrong keyboard. Get command. Here are all the commandlets that start with get. Here are all the computer-related commandlets. So as far as discovering what the commandlet is to do something, using get command with some options there helps you find it. You can also use wildcards. Here are all the commandlets that, well, there's a couple aliases, but here are all the commandlets that have something to do with web, the word web. One important thing to remember about get help is PowerShell 3.0 does not ship with help files. It doesn't. It's real confusing at first, but there's what the problem is that the file that they have to ship becomes bigger and bigger and bigger because of all the different language support they have to have for all over the world. So they elected to reduce that by simply saying, once you get it, once you're going to set up your system, use the update help commandlet, update dash help commandlet. That will then download all of the help for your server at this point in time, specific to your locale. Now, from what I understand, the only thing they've done fully fully baked for help is English, and I apologize for that. They're in Washington. But the other benefit you get through Update Help is that as they fix the help topics, and they're always fixing the help topics, you can, by doing Update Help, you always get the latest help. So I'd say probably once a month or so on your personal system, update your help. On your server, why would you need help on your server unless you're spending time in RDP on there? And I recommend you don't do that. Okay, use PowerShell remoting and work from your client system and have your help updated on your client. Yes, ma'am. If you're working on an internal network, what you'll need to do, if you're working on an internal network, obviously you can't update help. What you'll have to do is you'll have to get access to the internet, do your update help to your client system. There are also downloadable help files that you can distribute, but I don't know the details of that because I haven't needed to do that, honestly. So the question is, because with respect to SQL Server, we don't want to have books online all over the place, so we simply have a single place where you access books online from by doing that. The thought process for the PowerShell team was, if you as an administrator working with PowerShell, you would have access to the internet from your workstation, and you can update help on your workstation. Your server, you shouldn't need to use help on your server because you're doing your work where you're trying to understand things on your workstation. For your colleague would then have to do the same thing. There may be a way that there's a downloadable process, some file that's downloadable that you can each use. That I'm not sure of, because I haven't run into that problem, to be honest. But this is that's something that we let me get back to you on that one. I'm going to have to look that one up myself, because it's really a great question as far as the help goes. But it's a command. Now, this is the command, update-help. And it will go, if you have access to the internet, it will reach out to Microsoft servers and update your help. I've already done that on this server, so it's current. So if I type in get help on help, there's my help information on get help. Tells me how to use it. It gives me the syntax with all the arguments for get help. Gives me a description, related links, and also get remarks. I can do dash detailed, dash examples, dash full, and dash online to access online help as well. So as far as downloading it so you can distribute that to other people within your organization, I can't answer that right now. I have not run into that problem myself, but I'll find out when I can, as soon as I can, and I'll blog about that. Speaking of which, my blog, if you go to sqlblog.com, if you look down the right-hand side, Alan White, I'm on the right-hand side, so I'll put up a blog post about this. All right. So let's move on. We're about 15 minutes into our time, and I don't want to waste everybody's time. Not that it's a waste. Don't get me wrong there. But we want to get into the meat of how we can use PowerShell with SQL Server. So the first thing I want to talk about is a system inventory. I mean, how many of you keep an inventory of the servers you manage? I'm seeing a lot of good hands. Thank you. That's awesome. You want to do that. You want to keep a track of all of the servers you manage in your domain. You want to be able to look at all of the configuration options on all of those servers to help you identify outliers, for example. I had a client call me up and say, I'm having real problems with performance on this one, in this one application, and we're not sure what's going on. Can you, take a look and help? And I simply ran a system inventory of all of the servers in their shop, and I'm looking through configuration options, and I saw that this one particular server had max server memory set to 512K. He was memory starving the thing. Of course it couldn't perform very well. But he never thought to look in the configuration options for that server. I'm simply looking at all of them, and I saw this one that was way out of whack with all the other ones. And something must have happened that somebody inadvertently changed that server. Maybe they thought it was a test server or something. But it allows you to see those outliers. All right. You can look and see the resource usage. How much memory you're using on your server? How much disk space are you using on your server? You can keep track of the usage of all of that. And then you can create reports that help you identify what you're doing with those servers so that you can actually justify those resources when you need them. So what do we collect? We collect the computer name, the domain, the make, the model. We collect the operating system information, the service and patch levels for all of both the operating system and the SQL Server stuff, our physical memory, our disk space, how much disk space are we using. We keep that over time. We go into SQL Server, collect the version information. How many of you have had to go through a SQL Server license audit? Wouldn't it be handy just to have this in one place? And that's one of the things that by maintaining this inventory, you always have it at hand. So when the boss says, hey, are we up to speed? You can say, yeah, we're in good shape. Cool. Right? So these are the kinds of things that I collect on a regular basis. Now, one of the great things about Microsoft is there with the Windows operating system is they've provided for us the Windows Management Instrumentation interface. Windows Management Instrumentation gives us access to just about everything as far as how our server is configured. The computer system gives us the name, the model, the manufacturer, the serial number sometimes, number of processors, etc. Operating system, it gives us the version, the patch level, all that information about the operating system. Physical memory, if you look at Win32 physical memory on a physical machine, it'll identify each memory card and its capacity, which I think is wonderful, when it was installed, those kinds of things. Logical disk is how we get access to how much space, how big the drive is and how much space is available. If you regularly gather that information and record it to your database, over time you can see your usage and you can predict roughly when you're going to need new disk space. And you won't be coming to your boss at the last minute saying, "Oh, boss, we're out of disk space. I need new disk space." No, you've already tracked it, and you've already prepared for that. And 6 months before you needed that disk space, you have it because you saw the trend based on polling Win32 logical disk. So how do we get WMI information? In PowerShell version 2 and version 1, use the get WMI object commandlet. That's what was built in. PowerShell 3.0 introduced getcim instance commandlet. It's a lighter weight process that uses WinRM. It uses that new lighter weight protocol, and it's a lot easier on your entire environment to use getcim instance. So that's recommended if you've upgraded to PowerShell 3.0. All right. But if you are still running PowerShell 1 or 2, use get WMI object. So let's take a look at what that brings us. You don't want to see me typing all this stuff, so I've used this great little tool that one of the PowerShell MVPs put together, Joel Bennett, out of Rochester, New York. It's called startdemo.ps1, and if you just do a web search on start-demo, you'll find this script that I'm using. Why aren't you working? There we go. All right, so here I'm saying get CIM instance. My query is select asterisk from Win32 computer system. And if I look at I'm assigning the results of that to a variable called $CS. And if I just type in $CS, it formats that object into a text form and tells me that the name of the system is SQL TBWS. Primary ownership is a Windows user. It's in the domain work group. It's got 2 gig physical memory. And yes, I use VMware Workstation for my demo machines, my test machines, because I'm running Windows 7. Windows 7 doesn't support Hyper-V. So I'm using VMware Workstation. So if I pipe that computer system variable to get member, it shows me that it's a variable, it's an object of type Microsoft Management Infrastructure CIM instance, and then it gives me the full path to that namespace, that WMI namespace. Here are the methods that are available to me for the computer system object, and here are all the properties. These are the things that are contained within that object, that computer system object. So number of processors is there, part of domain. It gives the domain information if it's available, the power state, et cetera. So I can look at each of those properties by simply saying $CS power state. Power state is set to 0. Status is OK. Total physical memory, 2 gig. That's in bytes, by the way. All right, so those are the things that you can do when you've gathered information using the computer system. Let's look at operating system. You can see it, my system directory information there, my build number, registered user. This is just what PowerShell did when it saw that object. It said, these are most likely the things the person is looking for. If I pipe that to get member, here are all of my properties that are available to me to look at. So I can look at the description, for example. Physical memory. There are all the properties that are associated with the physical memory. And this just shows their name and their data types of each of those properties. So I can see that I've got the 2 gig memory there. And then Win32 logical disk. So you can see that. Now, I always select drive type equals 3. That way, I avoid pulling in data from any mapped drives. But drive type 3 does is valid for like SAN drives, the drive space that is allocated to you on your SAN. Those are all drive type 3, so you can get this information back. You can see I have 3 drives, each 40 gig, and I've used half of my C drive and less of the other 2 drives. It just so happens that the data is where my SQL Server databases live, and the log drive is, of course, where my transaction log files live on this server. But by taking this information and storing it in my database, I can then track over time the usage of that disk space. But we need SQL Server information too, because we're SQL Server people, right? It's not just the operating system information we need. Microsoft created the Server Management Object API back when they released SQL Server 2005. The great thing about SMO is it supports all versions of SQL Server back to SQL 2000 up through SQL 2014. Yes, I've already worked with it. So they just made it available this week. I hope you're getting ready to go home and download it if you haven't downloaded it already. But SMO is still supported in SQL 2014. It gives you access to the management objects. It's not something where you're going to run T-SQL scripts. It's where you're going to interrogate and make changes to your SQL Server environment to manage. And SMO and PowerShell work very nicely together. Now, you do have to load some DLLs in native PowerShell to access the SMO objects. You do that with the SMO, Microsoft.SQLServer.SMO DLL that comes in the C program files, Microsoft SQL Server 110. And that number is dependent on your version number. So I haven't looked at the number for the new SQL 14, but it was 90 for SQL 2005 and 100 for SQL 2008 and 2008 R2. So the 110 was specific to SQL 2012. But you go into the assemblies, the SDK assemblies directory, they're there. SQL 2005, everything was in the SMO DLL. SQL 2008, things got kind of big, so they moved things like backup and restore into the SMO extended DLL. And they moved the managed computer object into the SQL WMI management DLL. So if you're working on anything 2008 or newer, you need those three DLLs for the SMO. But I'm going to show you an easier way in a moment. All right, so we connect to the server in SMO by instantiating using the new object commandlet, an object of type Microsoft.SQLServer.Management.SMO.Server. It actually becomes easier after a while. It's not that hard. But what we're doing is we're instantiating an instance object of SQL Server instance, and we're storing that in a variable called $SVR. And then we can pull that variable and see what's in there. What does our server look like? There are two subdirectories. I'll show you those in a minute. Information and settings that have most of the information that we need. All right. If I want to access, how many of you run Configuration Manager, SQL Server Configuration Manager? I was hoping most of you. That lives in the managed computer object. So it's Microsoft SQL Server Management SMO WMI managed computer, and you connect to the machine name, not to the instance name. Microsoft hasn't created great diagrams for SMO, so I tried to do that myself. So off of the server object, your configuration options are in the configuration directory underneath server, right? Settings and information contain most of the server, the instance level information that you're looking for. Things like where your master database files live, where your backup directory is, those kinds of things. Backup devices, your endpoints for if you're using Service Broker or if you're using replication, if you're using database mirroring, those all endpoints will be defined in the endpoints subdirectory. Your logins are all defined there. You can track who has active logins in your server. There's a directory for your databases, and job server is where all of your agent jobs and alerts live. If we go into the databases collection under the server object, there are individual database objects in that databases collection. And each database object has a file groups collection. In that file group object, it tells you whether it's the default file group, and it has a collection of the individual files in that file group. So we can query SMO to find out the details about the physical files behind our SQL Server databases. So we can track individual file growth over time and record that so we anticipate running out of space. We can alleviate those issues by looking at that information. Of course, your log files don't belong to a file group, so it's the same structure just without the file group structure. Yes, sir. The question is, are these read-only? And the answer is no. You see the alter method? You can change these. I would be cautious. I tend to change database file stuff through T-SQL more than through SMO, but you can change it through SMO. Yes, using the alter method. Same rules apply, though. If anybody's using it, you obviously can't, right? All right. I mentioned the managed computer object. I mentioned that you've already worked with this through the configuration manager. If you look at the various categories, the various folders under the managed computer object, you should see some patterns here. Client protocols, you can establish the client protocols in configuration manager. Your server aliases, if you've set up any aliases. Here are the objects that you're using behind the scenes. Server instances, if you've got multiple server instances, and this category here is where your I wanted that. The server protocols and IP addresses. Under IP addresses here, if you drill down, is where you can actually set your IP port. And I prefer doing this through a PowerShell script using this object. And I've had to do this on a number of occasions in my life where, as I'm rebuilding an instance because something dramatic has happened, the application was coded so that it used a specific IP port. I have a script that fixes that, so that resets the instance to that IP port, so everything continues to work. The one you're probably most familiar with is the services category. If you go, that first tab in Configuration Manager lists all your services, SQL Server services on your instance. Patterns after the exact same information here in your managed computer. So let's look at a demo. The first thing I'm going to do here is I've got a script, and if you go to my blog post right after I presented this same session in New Orleans, I posted the demos, all the scripts that I'm doing right here, they're already up on my blog. So if you go to sqlblog.com, look for my name, Alan White, go to my posting about the New Orleans tech ed, and this is the same deck and the same demo scripts. So you can download that right now if you'd like. But there's a script here called initialize SQL PS environment. And what that does is it runs a script by Michael Warez. Michael was the developer for Microsoft who created SMO, and he created the PowerShell extensions for SQL Server. So he wrote all this code, and in 2008, he wrote a blog post and provided us this script that loads all of the SQL Server extensions that exist in sqlps.exe. We load them into PowerShell directly. This is how you work with PowerShell if you're working with SQL 2008 or earlier. If your client side is set up with SQL 2008. So once we've run initialized SQL PS environment, we have loaded all those DLLs for SMO. Remember I said I'll make it easier. You don't have to remember what those all are. I've provided this script for you in the download, and I've given you a link to Michael's blog post. If your client side is set up with SQL 2012 or newer, it's simpler actually. Use import-module. Modules were introduced in PowerShell 2.0, which didn't exist yet when they created the SQL 2008 interface. So SQL 2012 released with a module called SQL PS. So import module SQL PS, which essentially does the same thing as what we've done right here. All right, so I've loaded the SQL Server extensions. Now I'm going to instantiate a new object of type SMO.server. and I'm going to put the results in $S. I'm going to look at the name. There's my instance name for that instance. I'm going to look at information. In information, you see the version. You see engine edition, resource version, build CLR version, not all of the useful information, but a lot of useful information at the instance level is available here to you through this information object. I've got my error log path right here. I've got my master DB path and master DB log path, so I know where my system database files live based on those values. My net name, SQL TBWS, so this is what this referred to on the net. Here's my resource version string. So this is SQL Server 2008 R2 SP2. Again, here's the text version of the version string. I can also look in settings. Settings has additional information, not in the information. Things like the backup directory and my default, my default file and default log directories. And I point this out simply because you notice the default file directory is empty. When the directory is empty, that means go look where the master files are. So what I do in my scripts as I test the default file property, and if its length is zero, then I go to the master file directory, because that's where the data lives. I asked the developer one time, I said, why do I have to do this? And he said, because it was easier. So it was easier for them, so that's the way it is. So we write the code in our script to deal with that. And I don't mean that as a slam. It's just one of those things. You do what you can to ship the product, right? So I've got a databases collection as part of that server object. I grab that databases collection to assign it to a variable, and I then pipe that variable to a select statement, selecting a set of properties about my databases that I'm concerned about. And here are my databases on my instance. Their compatibility level, their auto shrink property, their recoverability, their recovery model, their size, and how much space is available. I can redirect this and put this data into my database and keep track of the size of and properties of my databases over time. I can go into an individual database simply by going into that databases collection, identifying in brackets a string with the database name on it, there's the name property for that database object. And here I've got a for each construct. So I'm saying for each, I'm giving a variable $FG, so for each file group in my database file groups collection, and then for each file in the files collection in that file group, pipe that file to a select statement giving me the name, the file name, the size, the max size, the growth, and the growth type. So I'm doing this against AdventureWorks. There happens to be only one data file for AdventureWorks, but if I had a whole lot of files, it would obviously bring me a whole lot of data. But here I've just got the physical information about the files that I need to track over time to make sure I'm not running out of resources. Fairly simple way of managing my server inventory. I can also gather using sys.configurations. You see I've got a query here. This is a T-SQL query, assigning it to a variable called $Q. I'm then using the new commandlet invoke SQL CMD, telling it my server instance is SQL TBS WS inst 01, my database is master, and my query is the query I've defined in my variable. I'm going to assign the results of that to a variable called $CFG. Oh, I need to fix something. Okay, there we go. to CFG, and here are all my configuration options without using spconfigure. But I can take these objects from within PowerShell and now write them to a database so I can periodically record the configuration. And if something's changing, maybe I might have a case where somebody's changing a configuration option and I'm not happy about it. I can track at least when it happened, right? If I record these on a regular basis. Yes, sir. Is it possible to collect one parameter from each SQL server in my entire domain of databases? Yes, it is. Absolutely. It's just a matter of either using the configuration object and working into that specific setting, or using a where clause on this particular query. Either way works. Does that help? One more? I have not worked with the cloud yet. I know that they're working to improve the interface, the PowerShell interface for SQL Server in the cloud. And there's a SQL Server MVP named Grant Fritchie who has been doing a lot of work in this space. He's here and will be at the Ask the Experts session right after my session here tonight. So, and if you come see me, I'll drag you over to Grant, because Grant and I are real good friends. And he's done some of this, and he can probably answer that question much better. Okay? All right. So again, using getMember, I can take any variable, pipe it to getMember, and you can see here are the properties. Because I did a select object to create this, it only has the properties I specified in my select statement, right? So, and then lastly, here's the I mentioned the managed computer object, and how it's very similar to the configuration manager. Where does this come into play? If you start working with SQL Server installed on Windows Server Core, there's no GUI for you to run configuration manager, but you still have access to all of this great information through the managed computer object. So I'm instantiating a managed computer object and assigning it to a variable MC, connect to my box, and I'm going to go and take the services collection under that managed computer object and pipe it to a select object statement asking for the name, the service state, the display name, and the service account. Kind of looks like what you see in Configuration Manager, doesn't it? Gives me all of the various services that I'm running, their service state, the display name, and the service account. And that's the most important thing to me. I want to know what service account is running. I can write PowerShell scripts that modify my service account and password, because periodically I have to go out and change all my passwords of my service accounts, right? Isn't it easier to do in a script rather than going into each individual run, right-clicking, and then going into properties and setting that? To me, that's really painful and very subject to error, human error. I'd rather script it and be done with it. All right. Performance data. How many of you guys capture performance data regularly and keep a baseline? I am very pleased to see those hands up. That's awesome. So many companies do not do this. If you have a baseline, you know how your server performs normally. Then when something goes wrong and things aren't performing normally, you have an idea what you can look and see what's different from your baseline to see what the problem might be. So you can focus on where the problem really is, as opposed to just haphazardly saying, well, it might be this, and it might be this, and it might be that. So capture a baseline, store your data, keep track of it, create reports that you can look at over time and see where problems are occurring. Okay. Now, frequency of capture is important. If you capture it too frequently, you can actually affect the performance by doing that. if you don't capture it frequently enough, you may miss important events. I have found that capturing performance counter data once a minute works pretty well overall. I'm only capturing 1,440 data points per day. I know that sounds like a lot, but it really isn't when, you know, think about inserting 1,440 rows of data in your database on a daily basis. It's not that much. That database doesn't grow very fast, but it's valuable data. I've seen people capture performance data like once a second. I wouldn't recommend that. That's probably a little abusive on your server. All right, so what counters are important? If you ask 10 different SQL Server experts, you'll probably get 10 different answers. So I'm just going to share with you what my choices are, and then you can research it further and decide what you're going to do, because I'm going to show you how to capture whatever counter it is that you want to play with, right? So I capture percent processor time because I want to know how busy my processor is. I capture available megabytes, memory available megabytes, because if I have more than just SQL Server running on a server, that other process might become memory intensive and thus affect my SQL Server, so I want to know that. I want to know how much memory is available overall. Paging file percent usage, if I see my paging file start to increase, that means I'm swapping out the disk, and that's a bad thing, so I want to keep track of that. Physical disk, average disk seconds per read and average disk seconds per write gives me latency information. There are all kinds of different I/O subsystems out there, and they all have different measuring criteria. But latency is latency is latency. No matter what the device is, the latency is what's important to us. How fast is that data coming back to us? If it's under 20 milliseconds, we're golden. We're good. It's okay. If we get over 20 milliseconds, I might be worried about it. If I get over a second, I'm really worried about it. And it doesn't matter what the I/O subsystem is. The latency numbers are consistent. So I keep track of the latency numbers. Yes, sir. The question is, does the disk queue length translate back into latency? No, it doesn't. In fact, disk queue length is so overloaded right now that it's almost unusable. I would talk to who is here? I would talk to Tom LaRocque. Tom LaRocque is here at this conference, and he should be downstairs after this session at Ask the Experts. If not, he'll be here tomorrow in the data platform area. And Tom works for Confio, and so Confio's got a really great suite of software that does this kind of thing. It's professional. It's way above what I'm doing here. And Tom can get into more specific detail on those counters, all right? I also look at processor queue length. If I've got more than 10 threads per process and my CPU percentage usage is high, I'm probably in a thread starvation scenario and I need more CPU. And I actually had that happen at a client site where their month-end processor was running like for 3 hours and nobody could do anything on their system for that entire 3 hours that they were running month-end. And so I looked at the performance counters. I went, can you guys give me some more CPU? They were running with 4 CPUs, and they were running on a virtual machine, so they doubled it. They increased it to 8, and that month-end process went from almost 3 hours down to about 45 minutes. They were very happy with me. I like making clients happy. All right, so these are the operating system counters that I capture. SQL Server counters I capture. Access methods, forwarded records per second, gives me an idea of if my heaps are getting fragmented. Now, sadly, the most effective way of defragmenting a heap is by BCPing the data out, recreating the table, and BCPing it back in again. Really kind of, you know, shoot myself in the head kind of a solution. But at least I know if I'm getting into that situation. Page splits per second. So I want to know how much activity is going on in splitting pages. You're always going to have page splits. The counter, even if you're tacking on pages at the end of a table, it counts that as a page split. But if I see unusual activity in this counter, I might want to look into it. Buffer cache hit ratio is less important than it used to be. In the 64-bit world, it's not that as important, but I still keep track of it. I don't know, it's just one of those things I love from a long time ago. Page life expectancy has gotten a lot of interesting press because people like to use it and they like to say, well, it has to be above 300 because Books Online said so. Books Online was wrong. Okay, Books Online wrote that when everybody was running 32-bit operating systems and the maximum memory you could have on a server was 4 gig. Okay, so Jonathan Cahias wrote a really great blog post about it. And if you want more detail about this particular counter, go to SQLskills.com and look for Jonathan's blog post about page life expectancy. And he recommends that it should be above the data cache size in gigabytes divided by 4 and multiply that by 300. And that's a reasonable number to look for. You will always have fluctuations in page life expectancy. And if you run DBCC check DB, as you should be doing, PLE will go down to the basement. It's just the way check DB works. All right. So expect that at certain points that number is going to drop. It's okay. It's part of the normal behavior of SQL Server. It's when it drops and it's not expected that you might want to look into what's going on. Somebody ran a report that they shouldn't have run during the day, right? You can see that because all of a sudden, all of those pages have to be brought in from disk because they're not part of your normal OLTP activity that you do online every day, right? So that's what I keep track of that counter for. Processes blocked. You're always going to have blocked processes, but I'd like to know if I have an unusual spike in that number. I want to take a look and see what was going on. Batch requests per second simply tells me how busy my system is. Okay? SQL compilations and recompilations per second. These numbers will grow if all of a sudden my statistics have gotten way out of date and SQL Server is going, hey, I can't use this query that I've already gotten the plan cache because it's not matching well, so it will recompile the query or the stored procedure, and these counters will grow. So this helps me keep track of that, and maybe I'll implement more diligent statistics management. All right, so these are the counters that I capture. In PowerShell, I can actually get the same results that you get in Perfmon by using the .NET system.diagnostics.performance counter object. I simply set the properties, category name, counter name, and instance name, to the proper value. I've instantiated that variable of type performance counter, and I use the next value method, and it just brings back the next counter value. Right? So for each of those counters, I instantiate the value, I use next value, I take those numbers and I put them into the database, I wait a defined interval, and then I do it again. It's that simple. The other way I do it is when I can't run my own PowerShell script to gather the data, I can use Perfmon and write the Perfmon output to the binary log file. And PowerShell 2.0 introduced the import counter commandlet, which allows me to then use the values in the binary log file. I can iterate through and pull out the counters that matter to me and insert those values, those cooked value properties from each of those values, and insert those into my database. So I've got two scripts, one that does it this way and one that actually runs on the server while the server is running, gathering the data. So I gather all that data, and I store it in a database I call server analysis. And I forgot to load this up ahead of time. While that's loading, let me show you the script real quick. I've got 10 minutes left. Here's the script that actively goes out and runs. Oh, I forgot to switch. I apologize. Here's a script that uses that performance counter data. So here's the code that I just showed you on that last slide. And then the same code for memory available megabytes. So what I'm doing here is I'm instantiating the operating system counters. This little chunk of code here is initializing empty collections, because the way I wrote this code is I don't know how many instances of SQL Server exist on this box. So I'm saying I'm going to iterate through each of those. And here, this particular code walks through the process of getting the right instance name, testing to see that that instance is running, and then going in and then creating the right counter name. Because a default counter for SQL Server will start with SQL SQL Server colon and then the counter information. But if it's a named instance, it's MSSQL $ instance name colon and then the counter data, right? So this code assembles that appropriately. And you see here access methods, forwarded records per second, page splits per second, buffer cache hit ratio, et cetera. So this is gathering, this is instantiating all of the performance counters for the SQL Server instances. And then here I've got code where I'm taking the operating system counters and putting them into the database. And here I'm putting the SQL Server counters and inserting those into the database. So that's that get perf code that you can play with. And here's the report that I get out of it. Can you see the performance pattern? Do you see the patterns of how the processor is used during the course of a day? What this shows is the last 35 days of performance for this particular server. So I can see percent processor use, my batch requests per second, my buffer cache hit ratio. Ignore the top line, because the top line is only a partial day. I'm using a reporting services 2008 R2 feature called Sparklines. And Sparklines will take and show you the entire, however much data it spans it across the space that's available for it, right? So that top day is only from midnight till 5 a.m., all right? All the other ones are full 24-hour period. But look at the pattern for page life expectancy. See, it's real high, then it drops down, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, DBCC check DB runs, and it drops down into the basement, and then it rises up, and it stays up, levels off for a while, and then a little after lunchtime, it drops down again, not to an unusual level, not to an unusable level, but it does drop down. So somebody does something right after lunch that causes a whole lot of disks to be swapped in and out, and then it starts rising up again. So that's a daily pattern. You can see it right there. So then when something happens that's outside of that pattern, you can go, I got something to look at. And if I want to, I can go in to individual detail. I'll click on the date. I mentioned to you guys about coming up and presenting before we started the session, that hopefully you'll take something that you love and share it with your colleagues. One thing you should always do is have water, because you will dry out. So if I see something that I don't like, I can click on the date, and it drills in, and I can look at the actual numbers instead of a sparkline graph. And I can see this is starting out at just under 25,000. It's dropping way down to next to nothing. It's running back up here. This drop-off right after lunch here is only coming down to just over 10,000. So it's really not as bad as it looks from the spark line. But by coming to this report, I can see that. Here's my batch request per second, my disk latency. So I've got some real disk latency issues in the wee hours of the morning. It's because everybody's trying to do all their backups all at the same time. And then, of course, I follow up all the graphs with the details. And if you go into next page, next page, next page, it's got all the detailed numbers for you to back up what the graphs are showing you. Right? So I show you these graphs. I've also got disk usage analysis. So I track on a once-a-day basis. I look at the amount of disk space that is the disk size for each disk and how much space is available. So this is the C drive, and over time it's pretty consistent. If I go to the H drive, you can see I've got 350 gig and it's floating here between 150 and 200 gig space free. But if this number starts to drop, I might want to take a look at that drive and maybe move things around so I don't run out of disk space on that drive. This drive is pretty consistent. There's one more here that logs kind of moves around a bit. Anyways, and then I also have database space analysis, where you can see this particular database, I had, a couple of autogrowth moments. Do we like autogrowth? No, not really. I want to manage that. So this is a database I need to go in and set at higher levels so we don't run into these autogrowth scenarios. There's another one in here. This one, the size is just growing incrementally over time. The space available is like next to nothing. Now, this happens to be not an active database. This is a developer usage. The developers use this database for their own purposes, so it's not critical to my business. I know that because I'm their DBA, and I know their business methodologies, right? But keeping track of this allows me to know what's going on so I can anticipate business problems just by having this and recording this data. Lastly, because we have about 3 minutes left, there was a project that a SQL Server MVP named Kendall Van Dyke created. Did I want this one? Yes. SQL PowerDoc is what it's called. It's available to you on CodePlex. It's a set of PowerShell scripts, and it comes with detailed descriptions on how to install it in your workstation and how to run it. Remember I showed you that managed computer object? Here's all that same information from managed computer. But wait, there's more. Here's the server overview with product name, startup name, install date, product edition, level, platform, etc. Here's server config. There's a whole bunch of config tabs of various configuration options. This is, again, this is a set of PowerShell scripts you can download from CodePlex, and at the end of the deck, I've got a link to the site where you can go and get this. All right. And I use this at client sites when I do a health check. I want to know what's there, right? Here are my server, all of my server level permissions, my server logins, server roles, credentials, audits, audit specifications, my endpoints, all of the endpoints. The things I showed you in the SMO objects, it's available here. And again, the code is all written in PowerShell. So you can evaluate that code and make changes to it if you'd like. These are all my trace events, my trace filters, trace flags, database mail accounts, mail profiles, mail security. Here is an overview of all of the databases on all of the instances on this box. Okay? You notice the recovery model. If I drill in to recovery model, you see I've got some inconsistency in my recovery model there. It might be something I want to take a look at. My database configurations, all of the physical files for all of my database and where they are. File groups. Again, database configurations, collations, recovery model, compatibility level, etc. Always on, change tracking, permissions, mirroring configuration, users, database roles, application roles, here's my schemas, etc. All of this information is just built. What Kendall did was he wrote a set of scripts that grab all of this stuff and put it into an XML document on your server. You then transfer that XML document from your server to your workstation where you've got Excel installed, and there's a second script you run it against it, and it creates this Excel document. But wait, there's more. Don't save. There's a second spreadsheet called Assessment that uses a similar type of thing to Brent Ozar's SP Blitz and Glenn Berry's configuration scripts, health check scripts that Glenn Berry has put out. And it evaluates your servers against known best practices and says, look, max server memory is set too high on these things. File growth is set to percent instead of physical size, right? All the kinds of things that you want to look at to check your server. Tempdb file count is not optimal. Partition allocation unit size isn't good. These are the kinds of things that, and this is all part of SQL PowerDoc that you can download. And it's PowerShell script using the techniques that I showed you in this session. Okay? We are exactly out of time, so let me go back to the last slide. If you're brand new to PowerShell, learn PowerShell 3 in a Month of Lunches by Don Jones and Jeffrey Hicks. Really excellent starter book. Understanding and Using PowerShell Support in SQL 2008. This is a white paper I wrote for Microsoft back about 4 years ago. There's a link to that white paper, so it kind of gives an introduction to the SQL Server specific aspects that you'll use with PowerShell. Back in February of 2009, I wrote an article on the Simple Talk website called Let PowerShell Do an Inventory of Your Servers. And most of the techniques I showed you in this session are used in that script that I wrote over 4 years ago. And then last thing is the link to Kendall's SQL PowerDoc project on CodePlex. I admit fully Kendall works for me, but that's okay. It's a really brilliant piece of code. It really is wonderful when I'm sitting at a client site and walking through that spreadsheet saying, we've got this issue, we've got this issue, we've got that issue. Here's the things we need to fix. So, do we have any questions? We are out of time. No? Then thank you so much. Please make sure that you fill out your evaluation. I look forward to it. If you do have anything that you can share with me, comments that will help me do a better job on this presentation in the future, please do so. Here are resources for you. And this, if you scan this, then that'll take you to the evaluation for this session. So thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing you downstairs. Thank you.